Okay, Constitution fans, here's a quick quiz. Who is the Chief Justice of the United States? Come on, you know this one. John Roberts, that's right. He's a good-looking fellow, very smart guy, too. Here's another one. Who was the very first Chief Justice of the United States? I'll give you a hint. Another John. That's right, John Jay. But now here's the kicker. Who was the first great Chief Justice of the United States? The first one the historians and the constitutional scholars will mention. John Marshall, that's correct. Well, today we're going to his house, courtesy of Jennifer Hurstwender and Preservation Virginia. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about John Marshall's house.
Your weekly constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
Jennifer Hurstwender is a lovely lady who is the head of an organization called Preservation Virginia, which does all sorts of marvelous things in our great commonwealth. And as its name implies, mostly what it does is it preserves and protects and, to a great extent, defends a very important historical structures in the Commonwealth. Now, if you're a regular listener, you've probably already heard me speak to Jen and her colleague, Joanna, all about a place called Bacon's Castle and an event called Bacon's Rebellion. And if you haven't heard that episode, go to our podcast site and listen to it because it's tremendous and exciting and really enlightening on a subject that many people find obscure. But that wasn't actually the first time Jen and I got together. It seems some weeks before I visited Bacon's Castle, she was kind enough to give me a private, guided tour of a place that I'd actually visited once before, and that is the historic home of John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice of the United States, but a person who is typically identified as the first great Chief Justice of the United States. Now, we've spoken about John Marshall on the show many times, especially in the context of his seminal opinion in Marbury versus Madison, which established the concept of judicial review, which is the heart of the Supreme Court's power. But we've never really talked about the man, John Marshall, and related that to his many accomplishments on the bench. The best way to do that, I've found, is to go visit his house, and the best person to tell you all about it is Jennifer.
Hi, my name's Jennifer Hurstwender, and I'm the Director of Museum Operations and Education for Preservation Virginia.
For all of Preservation Virginia?
Yes.
Well, I'm very impressed then. What is Preservation Virginia?
Well, Preservation Virginia is a statewide historic preservation organization. We're actually the oldest statewide preservation organization in the nation.
Wow.
We were founded in 1889, and so last year we celebrated our 125th anniversary. And we were founded to save a couple of properties. One of them was the historic church on Jamestown Island, and mm-hmm. the other one was Bruton Parish in Williamsburg.
Oh, I've been to Bruton Parish, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. And so from those beginnings, we have saved hundreds of historic places across the state. And sometimes saving these historic places means taking ownership and turning them into historic sites. So currently we operate five core historic sites plus also historic Jamestown.
Wow. And you're in charge of all this?
Well, I'm not in charge of historic Jamestown.
Everything but Jamestown.
Right. But the five core sites that we operate, the John Marshall House, which we're at now, mm-hmm. Patrick Henry's home, Scotchtown.
I'm going there. Maybe you and I'll go there sometime.
That sounds
okay.
Great. Cape Henry Lighthouse, which mm-hmm. is the first federally funded public works project.
Cool.
And by the United States government. Mm-hmm. And that one's in Virginia Beach. And then we have two properties in Surrey County. We have Smith's Fort Plantation and also Bacon's Castle. And Bacon's Castle is celebrating its 350th anniversary.
This is like a smorgasbord, and you and I will be seeing each other in the future, apparently. Okay, so that's tremendous. Before we go, I have to ask, was the Cape Henry Lighthouse, was that built by Alexander Hamilton? Yeah. He was one of the, that was a big thing for him. Okay, but I didn't mean to digress there. I know we're going to have to talk about that sometime.
No, it's fantastic. And, you know, they all relate because we have the John Marshall House, and he was such a Federalist. You know, mm-hmm. He really wanted the strong central government.
Right.
And then, of course, you have Patrick Henry, you know, who's
just the opposite.
Exactly. And then you have the Cape Henry Lighthouse, which really... It's one of the first things that the federal government is able to do,
mm-hmm.
And it's the power of that strong federal government.
Once Hamilton, the evil genius, took over, at least according to Henry, that was one of the first major public works. That is so cool. I've heard about the lighthouses. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that you had one here, so that's why we took that little digression down there. But that's tremendous. So Preservation Virginia, big organization, lots and lots of sites,
right.
And you've done some great work over the last 100 and some odd years,
mm-hmm.
And so that's tremendous. And thank you for coming in and telling me about the John Marshall House today.
Of course. Well, it's an honor, and the reason that we're here is because the legacy of John Marshall is so important. That's
well, who was this guy, John Marshall?
So,
it sounds like a pretty common name.
Well, John Marshall was the fourth Supreme Court Chief Justice,
mm-hmm.
And it was really under his leadership of the Supreme Court that the judicial branch really gained footing as a third and equal branch of the United States government.
Right.
He's the longest serving Chief Justice. He serves from 1800 until his death in 1835. So, and it's under his tenure that really the Constitution is interpreted and defined by the Supreme Court that really came into being.
Right. Chuck Hobson calls him the first great Chief Justice.
Right.
So yes. He wasn't the first.
No.
There were three before him.
Yes.
But he was the first one who really took the reins and ran with it.
Right.
And as I'm sure we'll get into, really set so many of the basic decisions, interpretive decisions, that made the country what it is today.
Right. And we can see the influence of those decisions in our day-to-day life for
mm-hmm.
things like interstate commerce and, you know, some of the modern cases that come up today, like how are we dealing with Edward Snowden and the idea of treason?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these kinds of things were the things that came up during Marshall's tenure. So it's a really exciting place to interpret.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do it. You just, I'm following you now.
All right. Well, the first thing that we're going to do right now, we're in the cellar of the John Marshall House, and we'll start and end here. But what we're going to do is actually go out onto the front porch, and kind of talk about the neighborhood in which John Marshall built this house. Been where the carriage turnaround would have been. This would have been where pretty much any of the people visiting the John Marshall House that weren't formal guests would have come through this way in the house.
So this is like coming in through the garage.
It's for familiars.
Yeah. It's not your living room. It's coming in through the family room.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, or through the kitchen door.
Through the kitchen door.
Yeah.
Got it. All right.
And so what we see, and I'm sure that you can hear, is you can hear a lot of buses. You can hear a lot of just commotion. We're right in the center of downtown Richmond. And this neighborhood, when John Marshall first bought this land and built this house, was called Court End. And Court End was the most fashionable neighborhood. At the time, you would have been able to see the newly built Virginia State Capitol, of which Thomas Jefferson was the architect. And it's a gorgeous federal building. It's pretty spectacular. And you also would have been able to see all the way down to the river. So Richmond at this time was the state capital, is the state capital, but it has a lot of dirt roads. Most of the houses are made out of wood. And in this neighborhood, high up on the hill here, above the smell and the commotion of the river.
And probably was a lot of smell and commotion.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
That was a major artery to get the James River, right?
Right, exactly,
okay.
Yes. So what you have is you have this area called Court End where lawyers and doctors and politicians are building their houses. And pretty much what they're doing is they're buying up basically square city blocks for urban plantations. So what you can see here is all the way to where the stoplight would be, and then all the way over to the end of the block would have all been John Marshall's urban plantation. So he was pretty smart, and what he did was he built this house in the bottom right corner of that square block. And he built a kitchen right off the back and a smokehouse. He would have built a laundry right where that large tree is over there. And then he also eventually built a two-story brick law office right where what we now have is the John Marshall Courts building.
Right.
And so the rest of the area would have been pasture for a couple of horses. There would have been a barn in the back. But the reason that he planned it out like this is so that if he ever needed to, he could also sell off one half of this property.
Right.
And still have everything that he needed in this one little area. Unfortunately, if anybody ever comes to visit the John Marshall House, you see the John Marshall Courts building, which looms very large right beside the house.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have a nice, big, preserved area here, but I think that probably is pretty unrealistic in the middle of Richmond. I mean,
right.
Yeah, who could hold on to all that property? The taxes alone would probably bankrupt most people.
Right. Well, we'll go ahead and go inside, get it where it's a little bit warmer, and I'll tell you about how this house ended up staying here right next to this large courts building.
Okay.
So the year is 1909.
Okay.
And John Marshall's granddaughters, he has two granddaughters, are living in this house. And they're using it as a rooming house just to kind of pay the bills. One of them is a widow. One of them was a spinster. And by 1909, they can no longer care for this house. Mm-hmm. So the city of Richmond purchases the property from the two Marshall sisters with the intentions of tearing it down.
And oh, boy. You're kidding me.
Well, the reason that they wanted to do that...
I hear things like that, and it just makes me angry, but okay, go on.
Well, the reason they wanted to do that is because they wanted to build John Marshall High School.
That's a worthy thing, but somewhere else. I'm sorry.
Right,
sorry.
Go on. Well, that's exactly how the people of Richmond felt. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as word broke that this was going to happen, a very early preservation movement occurred in the city. And so you had the newspapers, you had the people pretty much almost rioting, saying there's no way that you're going to tear down John Marshall's house and build a high school called John Marshall High School. It's just not going to happen. The movement was led entirely by women, which in 1909 is pretty exceptional.
You all did not have the right to vote for almost another, 15 years?
Yeah.
Close to it, yeah.
Right.
11 years, I guess, yeah.
Yes. So it's
well, good for you.
It's fascinating.
Thank you, ladies.
That influence,
okay.
Right. And so what ended up happening is that the city built the high school right off of the back of the John Marshall House. And they did preserve the house itself.
But they took the law office, didn't they?
They did.
Which still kind of makes me angry.
Yeah.
That would have been very nice to have. I mean, that was still here in 1909.
It was still here, as was the two-story kitchen. So
Well. I guess I should be thankful for what's still here. All right, go on, please.
Right, and there was no archaeology done. It was.
So you mean like the foundations of that house might still? Well, I guess not. They probably dug down too deep. So they lost all that history.
They lost all that history. Right.
Oh,
right.
Geez.
But the city did deed it belonged to the city. The John Marshall House belonged to the city, but they allowed what was the Preservation Virginia's first name was APVA, Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities. And we were allowed to operate it as a historic house. So we opened it up in 1911, and it's stayed open except for a brief time during World War I since 1911 as a historic house.
Very impressive.
Yeah, it's got a really long run, so we're really happy about that.
Mm-hmm. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm on a tour of John Marshall House. That is the historic home of John Marshall, the first great Chief Justice of the United States, a place that still stands right in downtown Richmond, Virginia. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll continue our tour of John Marshall House, guided by the inimitable Jennifer Hurst Wender. Stick around. time, he's wearing his Union Jack as a headband. Looks sort of like a pirate. But I'm guessing that because it's a Union Jack, that once again, we have something to do with the British Constitution or with sort of Anglo-American constitutional law. Is that a good guess?
Yeah, it's talking about Magna Carta, although if I had thought about it with the R comment, I probably would have talked about Barbary pirates being backed by the British in the War of 1812.
We could have done that.
But we didn't.
But you screwed it up.
Yeah. Sorry.
That would have been a really good thing, Doug.
R.
Do we have anybody on the line?
Yes, we do.
Well, who do we have?
We have Gary Growl.
And where's Gary Growl from?
I live in Gay City, Virginia, but I work for Northeast State Community College in Blountville, Tennessee.
Tremendous. What do you teach there?
I teach business and small business.
Right. Tremendous. Well, does that have anything to do with the Constitution?
Yes, it does, because in a business law class, we talk about all these wonderful amendments, like 2 and 4 and so forth.
Well, tremendous. Let's give him a really tough one then, Doug.
No.
You absolutely. No, I mean, now that you've established your bona fides, we've got to test them out.
Gate City, Virginia, up there with the Kilgore family.
It is, actually. Yeah, it's a very prominent political family. It's just north of Kingsport, Tennessee. It's kind of because Virginia kind of comes in above Tennessee at that point.
I've been there.
You've been to Gate City.
Mm-hmm. You've been to Gate City? Goodness.
Yeah, I have.
I've been to Gate City. I have friends in Gate City.
As a matter of fact, we have a sign when you come in. Kilgore was the attorney general.
That's right. He was.
And even though after he left that post, they kept the sign up.
Well, I mean, you got to claim what you got, right? He's a prominent local son. Jerry Kilgore, right? Exactly. All right.
If I remember correctly, he was the better looking of the twins, what he called himself.
Now, that I have no opinion on.
Magna Carta.
All right, Doug.
All right, Gary, here it comes. I'm going to read you the question. I'm going to give you 4 choices to answer. Which clause from Magna Carta no longer remains in force in the UK?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, can you give him some answer choices?
I'm going to give him some. Which clause in the Magna Carta no longer really remains in force in the UK? Is it A, freedom for the English church, B, the right to due process, C, no one shall be arrested or imprisoned upon the appeal of a woman for the death of any other than her husband, or D, that London is guaranteed ancient liberties and rights.
So which of those 4, Gary, is no longer good law?
Let me give you those choices again. A, freedom for the English church. B, the right to due process. C, no one shall be arrested or imprisoned upon the appeal of a woman for the death of any other than her husband. Or D, London is guaranteed ancient liberties and rights.
I think I'm going to go with C.
I'm not even going to ask you about the other ones because that's got to be the easiest one you've ever done.
Not at all.
Absolutely. I hope that's correct.
The man is from Gate City, Virginia. What is he going to know about English law based on a document from 800 years ago?
So you thought it would be easy only because he's from Gate City.
I know people at that fantastic law school down there in Grundy that don't know that much about Magna Carta.
Okay, but he got it right, didn't he?
He sure did. Gary, you got that right. Congratulations. Magna Carta, of course, 800 years old. This year, there's not a lot that survives those 63 clauses that got signed there at the shores of Runnymede. It's really just by the Thames, to be honest with you. It's not really a shore. But 3 things that do survive are the freedom of the English church, of course, the right to due process, and that London is guaranteed these ancient liberties, which there's some debate what those liberties might be. But mostly it's things like they don't have to field soldiers in the event that London will be attacked. And there's some taxation issues there and things like that. But generally speaking, London and its 5 ports were the only city called out by name in the Magna Carta.
That is very interesting. But what's interesting to me is that, it's the barons. The barons are forcing King John to give them certain rights.
And the church. Don't forget the church.
Right, okay. But C, in this particular case, isn't it interesting? And this really illustrates why, although this was the genesis of a lot of our rights, it was very, very different from today. These barons wanted protection from women's testimony.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They considered that their right. Isn't it interesting how our conception of rights has evolved from just being something that's for privileged men and has now extended to women?
That's right.
I'm guessing most people think that's a good thing.
Most people think that's a fantastic idea.
Over 50% of America.
Yes. I think it's probably a good thing. I
Even
think we can
higher.
Probably agree on it. I don't think it's too controversial anymore.
In my house, there's four of us, and five of us think that that's a great thing.
Well, Gary, well done. Well done. If you will send us an email to ywc@montpelier.org. We will, and give us your t-shirt size and your physical address. We will send you your t-shirt, your YWC t-shirt, and your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Wonderful. I'm so pleased.
Thanks very much. And thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Stuart. It's the Constitution. Gary and I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in Richmond, Virginia. I'm on a tour of the John Marshall House. That is the historic home of John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice of the United States, the first great Chief Justice who did all sorts of important things in our constitutional history. And we're learning about those things through this tour of his house, courtesy of Jennifer Hurst Wender of an organization called Preservation Virginia. And before the break, she was just starting to tell me about how Preservation Virginia actually came to be in possession and have a responsibility for the John Marshall House.
Interesting things that happened during that time when the two granddaughters of John Marshall believed that the house was going to be demolished. They pretty much had almost like a yard sale for the furnishings.
Jeez. You're breaking my heart here, Jennifer.
I know. And so many of the pieces, luckily, did go to other Marshall descendants. Basically,
right.
these two ladies needed to they needed to get some money.
Sure.
to live the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the pieces did go back into other Marshall family members' homes. But as soon as everything logistically worked out and APVA was going to manage the house as a historic house museum, luckily we had the receipts to track down a lot of the people who had purchased these Marshall pieces
mm-hmm.
and get them back into the house. So we currently have just under 50% of original Marshall pieces in the house.
Do you know where the others are?
Some of them...
We're going to go out and get them in
well,
the dark of night?
The great thing about the Marshall family is that John Marshall was the oldest of 15 children.
Jeez Louise.
And they all survived to adulthood.
Wow.
His mother was amazing.
She was.
And then he had...
Did she survive?
All 15?
No, did she survive those 15 births?
She did.
That
yes.
is amazing. A lot of women died in childbirth.
I know,
then. Okay.
So yeah.
Congratulations, Mom. Okay.
And then John Marshall and his wife, Mary Ambler Marshall, better known as Polly, they had 10 children and 6 of them survived to adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what I'm saying is there's a lot of descendants. And so what ends up happening is a couple of times a year we have descendants that maybe they have a dining room table that their children didn't want, and so they give it to the house, or they have a rocking chair that nobody else in their family wanted, so they give it to the house. And so we're extraordinarily lucky that we have.
So if there are any Marshall descendants listening...
Right.
They can email you, and you'll be happy to come get that next artifact, right?
Right.
Okay,
exactly.
Good. I like that. All right.
So we've operated the house since 1911, like I mentioned, and it's gone through several remodels, and we've gotten new pieces. It's funny to look back at the history and see some of the changes over time, and we're lucky enough to have that opportunity since it's been open as a historic house pretty much the entire 20th century, over 100 years. And it's not only a great way to talk about John Marshall, but it's a great way to talk about changes in historic house interpretation over time, too.
Sure.
So that's really neat. I guess we'll go ahead and start talking about the room that we're in and get back to John
Marshall.
Okay,
yeah, we're in what looks like an entrance foyer here.
Right. So, like I mentioned before, coming up into this way would have been where goods would have been delivered. It would have been where food would have come in from the kitchen. It would have been basically the kitchen entrance in a modern-day house. It's where there was no carpet in this room. You had a floor cloth in this room, so that any mud could just be swept out pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
This house is built in the federal architectural style, so it's losing a lot of that symmetry that was in the Georgian style, and it's going a little bit more towards that neoclassical design. Kind of in the same influence of the state capitol is also a federal architectural building. Now,
for those of us who don't know about architecture, when I hear federal, I think of not necessarily, as you say, not necessarily symmetry, but lots of right angles.
It's very
sort
square.
Of square and
exactly
then red
right.
brick.
Well, mostly red brick, but a lot of times you get, especially in Washington, D.C., a lot of the architecture in D.C. is federal style, so that's a lot of white stone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on what the local building material is.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. But you don't have front porches, really. It's very flat, so, you just have kind of stairs leading up into the doorway. There is still a little bit of symmetry, but it's nothing like the Georgian style. It really harkens back to the pediments. You get some of the times the Palladian windows, Italianate a little bit.
Yeah, in fact, this reminds me of a podcast that I shared with you about Gunston Hall, and that was very much a Georgian style. In fact, they were so obsessed with symmetry there, they put in false windows and things, just even when they didn't need them, just so that everything would look symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's if you're interested in architecture, just pull up the Gunston Hall podcast, the one about George Mason, another Virginia founder. Okay, but anyway, beyond architecture, so let's go on.
So comparing again, if you want to compare John Marshall to Mason and Gunston Hall, another part of federal architecture is the usefulness. And this house really embodies usefulness over frivolity. So it's,
you're calling George Mason frivolous. Is that it? They're all going to get mad at you over at GMU now.
No, I don't mean that.
Oh, okay. All right.
But it is fancier. And if you look at a contemporary of John Marshall who lived two blocks away, John Wickham, his house is just a little bit later, about 15 years later than this house. But Wickham was a man who wanted to show off. So that house, you go into it and you are wowed.
This house was built in 1790.
1790.
So he would have been 1805.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Right.
And the Wickham house is still there. Okay.
The Wickham house is part of the Valentine Richmond History Center. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic. If you haven't had a chance to go over there, you really should.
I'll put it on my list.
Yeah. And we here at the Marshall House love for visitors to visit both houses so that you can really get a comparison of the simplicity but good craftsmanship of this house.
This reminds me of arts and crafts houses, you know, which would be like 100 years later because you've got lots of wood, and it does look more homey than a Georgian house. Now, I don't know anything about architecture. I'm just talking about my impression. I'm sure you can tell me 15 different differences between this and arts and crafts, but you got the hardwood floors, you've got wooden doors, lots of exposed wood at various places. Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent in my mind.
Right. So getting back to this room, it was a useful area. And right off of this room, we have a butler's pantry. This butler's pantry, it's whitewashed. It's very utilitarian. And we believe that this was where John Marshall's enslaved valet, Robin Spurlock, this would have been his office. Mm-hmm. He pretty much ran the household. It's really interesting, the idea of urban slavery versus rural slavery, what you typically think of as the Southern style plantation, because in the urban, in Richmond especially, which was huge, it was, except for New Orleans, it's the largest slave importation site in the United States.
Right. So the slave trade was sort of centered here on the East Coast.
It really was.
I guess Charleston was the other big East Coast city where slave trading was going on.
Right.
Yeah.
It really has to do with Richmond being on the fall line of the James.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody further west would have come to Richmond to purchase slaves.
I see.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about urban slavery is that you're using the slaves to run a household. So Robin Spurlock, he's pretty much making sure that everything in this house runs appropriately. We have stories of him basically dressing Marshall, picking out his clothes for him. Otherwise, so there's also stories of John Marshall forgetting his trousers en route and just not wearing any to the bench when he's running the circuit court.
Wait a second. John Marshall running around with no pants on?
It's a story that he wrote in letters back to Polly saying that he had forgotten his pants. And the pants that he was wearing were just so covered in mud from the travels.
Oh, okay, he did have pants on. He just
no,
had.
No, he didn't wear them to the bench.
So wait a second. So he did have pants, and the pants were the ones he rode in.
Right.
Okay,
right.
But he didn't want to wear those mud spattered pants when he went. So he just put his robe on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a perennial question. What judges have on under their robes? And so we know that the most important judge in American history once did go on the bench with no pants. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that is something I never knew.
Yeah.
If you remember nothing else from this episode, remember that. John Marshall with no pants. Okay, go on, please.
He was not to be deterred.
Not to be a determined guy. All right, good.
And also Robin Spurlock, he's very much a part of the Black Richmond community. He's the leader of his church, the Baptist Church, and he himself is known to be a pretty snazzy dresser. There is a story about him purchasing some bright yellow knickers and going out with these fantastic socks on, and it being mentioned because, you know, this is John Marshall's valet, and so people around the town were commenting on it. He ends up outliving John Marshall by a few years. And it's interesting because John Marshall and Monroe are both founding members of the American Colonization Society.
Right. And this was a Back to Africa movement?
Exactly.
For emancipated slaves.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. And so in John Marshall's will, he gave Robin Spurlock the option of going to Liberia, which... and being freed and going to Liberia, or staying enslaved and living with his daughter Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin Spurlock.
Well, that, I mean, in one sense, nice to have an option other than slavery, but basically you can't stay. You
right.
have to go to Liberia, which, of
yeah.
course, was a country founded specifically for that purpose.
Right. Well, and you have to imagine that Robin Spurlock by this time is, if he's not 80, he's close to it.
Yeah,
yeah. So I don't know how great of an option that really was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not the best option. Okay.
So, but the fact that, I mean, and the, I won't get into the American Colonization Society that much.
Sure,
but
sure.
It really is an interesting thing that they were trying to find solutions of how to wrap their heads around the idea that we're talking about freedom, we're talking about these age of enlightenment, and yet we are slaveholders.
Yep.
And so this was... an idea that they came up with that seemed very relevant and like a good idea at the time, but looking back on it...
You know, slavery was our original constitutional sin and our greatest contradiction.
Yeah,
of course, we
absolutely.
Had to fight a war over it, but even well-intentioned people who were trying to find a way out of it were confronting all sorts of additional issues. I mean, if you're going to have freedom, where do the slaves go? Do they stay here?
Right.
Does that create problems? Is that going to be something that is desirable or not? Typically from the white perspective, as people were looking at it, and one quote-unquote solution was simply mass deportation is what it came down to, which was not only impractical, but of course very objectionable by our modern standards. We don't want to engage in presentism, but these are all very difficult and sensitive subjects to discuss, but it's important that we remind ourselves that those are the issues they were wrestling with.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And I'll give you a compliment. You guys are facing up to this very straightforwardly, so good for you.
We found that our visitors are extraordinarily interested in that.
Yeah.
We're not trying. This is not the deification of John Marshall. This is to really understand where our country came from.
Sure.
I think we have to talk about these kinds of things.
I agree.
Yeah. So from this room, we'll go ahead and we'll move over, I guess, into the parlor. And right above the fireplace here, we have, this is Mary Randolph Keith Marshall. So this is the illustrious mother of John. And
she of the 15 births?
Yes, this is
her.
Wow,
okay,
right.
Impressive woman.
Right. But quite. I don't know if it has something to do with the fact that she's from the Randolph line.
Mm-hmm.
And so
one of the first families of Virginia, right?
Right,
yes.
Yes. And it's through her that John Marshall is second cousins to Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And so her and Thomas Marshall, John's father, they are actually living in a log cabin. No joke, John Marshall was born in a log cabin.
Wow.
Yeah. In Fauquier County, so that's near, it's northwest of Richmond by quite a bit. It's in the mountains, in the foothills of the mountains. And so Thomas Marshall is a surveyor. He's a surveyor with George Washington. They know each other. They're pretty good friends. And John is the first child born to the family. A couple years later, they move to a larger wooden structure that they build, and they call it the Hollow. And then by the time John Marshall is 17, they've built a pretty substantial house called Oak Hill, which is still in existence. The Hollow is actually still in existence also.
Really? Is Oak Hill open for visitors?
Oak Hill is currently it's being used as a winery. So you can, and they have a couple of bottles that are John Marshall featured wines. They have Silver Heels and I think it's Chief Justice Red.
We'll talk about Silver Heels, I'm sure. That is a very significant name that I'm going to speak to my wife now. Did you hear that, honey? We can go visit one of these sites I drag you to, and we can drink. Yes, okay. My wife enjoys a glass of wine occasionally, so maybe I'll get her to come with me to Oak Hill.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm on a tour of John Marshall House in Richmond, Virginia, the historic home of John Marshall, our first great Chief Justice, courtesy of Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation, Virginia, who's just been telling me that John Marshall had several historic homes in Virginia and that more than one of them exists. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and continue our tour of John Marshall House. Stick around.
Know exactly how James Madison came into possession and effective management of the Montpelier plantation. Since he was the eldest son, despite his absorption in public life, Virginia tradition strongly favored his assumption of that privilege and responsibility. In the 1780s, his letters to his father and to his brother Ambrose show clearly that they were in charge at Montpelier. Cousin Francis Taylor's diary likewise pictures James Madison as a politician and scholar who, until the mid-1790s, really only visited in Orange County. He wrote about the plantation during visits home, encouraged scientific farming methods, purchased supplies in Philadelphia, and sometimes oversaw the marketing of Montpelier produce, but otherwise he left things to his father and brother. As late as 1787, he held virtually no property in his own name, a fact which has led some students to rank him among the least substantial members of the Federal Convention. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm with Jennifer Hurst Wender of Preservation, Virginia, who is kindly taking me on a private tour of John Marshall's historic home in Richmond, Virginia. Now, John Marshall was our first great Chief Justice, and it's a matter of historical record that he did enjoy a glass of wine from time to time. So perhaps it's apparent, or appropriate, I should say, that one of his earlier homes, a place called Oak Hill, is now a winery.
In fact, I think I've seen some Oak Hill labels.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that it was the early Marshall House. Is that where he more or less grew up then?
Oak Hill? It was built when he was 17.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't spend that much time before heading off to fight in the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
But it was deeded to him, and so it was his retreat during his adult years.
Oh, okay.
And then eventually he deeded it to his son. So it stayed in the family for quite a bit. Yeah. So again, we have Mary, mother of John, and during the early formative years, both John Marshall's mother and father were extremely knowledgeable, well-read in the classics. People, so they expected their children to do the same. They hired a couple of tutors for John Marshall. They did send him away for a year to Lord Fairfax's house to be schooled there, and I believe that he was with Monroe Yes. Mm-hmm. He studied with Monroe while he was away for a year. And otherwise...
So he was on the western frontier of Virginia, mm-hmm. in a very sort of an edge area, mm-hmm. with the log cabin and all.
Right.
But he had educated parents, mm-hmm. and he had some formal education.
Right.
Okay.
He had 1 year of formal education, and then the rest of it, they would bring local parish tutors.
Okay.
And we have in John Marshall's accounts several of the books that he was purchasing. He was a really big fan of Alexander Pope, mm-hmm. Livy, and a lot of the other Enlightenment authors. And actually, when we talk about the XYZ affair in a bit, he stayed at the Maison de Valette, which was the Madame de Valette was the goddaughter of Voltaire.
Oh.
And she had a wonderful French salon, which people were coming to all the time.
So he was he went to France.
He did, yeah.
Okay.
It was one time abroad. So we'll get there.
Okay, we'll get there. Okay.
So just to kind of throw some dates out there, John Marshall was born in 1755. Mm-hmm. And this house that we're in right now was completed in 1790. So he's 35 years old by the time that he's living here. And he passes away in 1835, just a month shy of turning 80. So he lives quite a long and fruitful life. Just a little bit about the room that we're in. We have one of the original coal-burning fireplaces in this house, so that's neat because most houses were being fueled by wood, but right outside of Richmond, there's the Midlothian coal mines. So this is one of the very first houses in Richmond that's built specifically to be coal-burning, so local resources and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see, a few other things. We have in this room, we have a harp. That was one of...
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah.
That's a called a grand harp or something.
It is.
I mean, that's a big one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this belonged to John Marshall's sister, one of the sisters. So
I think you need some strings.
Not anymore, no.
No, no.
This is one of those things where we've seen pictures from the 20s where it had strings and we cringe.
Really, why?
Well, because we don't want it to warp or, you know, the strings to break it now. It's just so old.
Oh, I see what you're saying. If we tried to string it now, we might crack it all apart.
Exactly.
I see. Don't want to put any tension on it.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah. but so with 14 brothers and sisters that grew up in the frontier, and then you have big brother John Marshall, who is he's a prominent lawyer. He's in politics all of the time. He's got this great house right in the center of Richmond. You can imagine that they're coming to visit their brother. And then when they have children, they're sending their children to stay here as well, to be brought out into society. And we have in more of Marshall's account books where John Marshall is paying for their subscription to the balls for that year, or all the events. So.
People can identify with that today. This is the successful brother, and so everybody's mooching off him.
I love it.
Okay, I understand.
There's a few of the nieces and nephews have actually been married in this room.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a room that's seen quite a lot of life. And the music book, in fact, is one of his sisters. She was writing musical notations in that book.
So. Now, this is a grand house, and he was a wealthy man.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't want to give the wrong impression. I mean, this is what I would say about 20 feet on a side, this room, something like that. It's not huge.
Right.
I mean, you could probably fit in a pinch comfortably 10 or 15 people in here, and if you really wanted to cram people in, mm-hmm. maybe twice that many.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about having a wedding here, it would have been a relatively small wedding by our standards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once a bride with her dress, she'd probably take up a quarter of the room. Okay, just wanted to set that for people. All right.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things as far as historic houses go is that the paint colors are chemically analyzed so that we know that these are the actual paint colors.
So you went down and found the originals?
Right. Throughout, when we painted over what was a more antiquated style of figuring out the house colors, which was looking at the bottom pieces of paint, taking a paint sample, looking at it, doing a visual analysis and matching that. And so the more modern way to do paint analysis is to, under a microscope, actually find out what the pigments in the paint were. And so by doing that, you can come up with the original color, bright and shiny and not aged.
Right, the original might have faded.
Exactly.
Or gotten dirty or whatever.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, the paint colors that we had in this house were very muted, and I think I've seen that at a lot of historic sites where it's just kind of like a more dull kind of color.
It's kind of funny. I recall some years ago there was a controversial cleaning of the roof of the Sistine Chapel. And it was controversial because when they cleaned it, it came out much, much brighter than it had been. And people said, well, that was the way it was. What you're seeing is us removing 300 years worth of soot.
Right. Exactly.
But people gotten used to it, you know, being muted. Mm-hmm. So you are going for the original color.
Right.
Okay. And you're pretty confident you've got that.
We're confident we've got that. And we're confident that it was a high gloss, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you're dealing with candlelight, the high gloss is going to reflect a lot more. We know that this room was wallpapered, and we know when. The pattern that we have in here would have been available in the catalogs that John Marshall would have looked at, but we can't say that this is the pattern that he would have had.
Understood.
Yeah.
So it's the best. I guess none of the original wallpaper survived, or at least not enough to analyze.
Right. Yeah. Okay. There's no remnants of the original wallpaper in this house.
Okay. Well, it's very pretty. I mean, good selection.
We were scared when we first got it. We opened up the box and we were like, "What did we just do?"
No. I mean, it's sort of green, and then there's a pink. Well, it's not that pink though. It's almost a purplish maroon pink.
Right, and it's yellow. And, so it looks
good.
I mean, when it came in the roll, we really were going, "Oh, we just got Easter colors."
it works.
It does. Okay. Just because the room is so dark. Yeah. It really does work. So I guess really quickly, I'll point out a few more things before we leave. The chairs that we have here were purchased by Marshall, and this is one of those sets that left during the yard sale and then quickly came back. Mm-hmm. And we have another one of these chairs that is at the Smithsonian in the American History Wing, and it's there as a John Marshall chair, kind of representative of the great Chief Justice. They're petite, they're fancy, they're from either New York or Boston, we're not sure which. But John Marshall was, as many of the founders were, he was a very large man, upwards of 6 foot, 6 foot one. And so these would have been very dainty for him. So in a style that kind of is very John Marshall, he takes these chairs to a local, or he takes a chair to a local Richmond craftsman and has a set made for him that mimics the style of these tiny chairs. So you have this kind of massive wooden chair with some casters on the bottom that would have fit John Marshall. And instead of having actual brass inlay, it has gilt painted inlay. And instead of actually being a mahogany, it's pine that's been stained to look like mahogany. But it's much more solid, and it's Richmond. So
what you're saying, this is John Marshall's recliner. Okay, there's the Barca lounger. Okay, John Marshall said, I don't want these little chairs.
Right.
But I'll get one that matches.
Right.
Okay,
exactly.
Good. But no, those are nice looking chairs. Yeah. All right.
And before we leave the room, I did want to point out there's a set of books in this bookshelf right here, and that's The Life of Washington.
Oh, the one that Marshall wrote.
Exactly. This is the first edition, five volumes of The Life of Washington. So after,
are those original? I mean, are those his copies of them?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's very impressive. Yeah. Did he inscribe them?
He writes his name in all of them.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I bet we can't touch them, can we?
We can, but I'd have to run upstairs and get some.
No. I'm not going to make you do that. All right. Okay.
But yeah, so John Marshall was asked by Washington's nephew, Bushrod,
Love that name, Bushrod.
I don't know why it's not common anymore.
I don't know. I wanted to name one of my kids Bushrod. My wife wouldn't let me. But go on, please, go on.
So this series of books was written, one or two years after Washington passed away. Mm-hmm. And
Early 1800s.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Right. And within about a two-year period, he was putting out one volume, and then 3 months later, he would put out another volume. And you can purchase the condensed one volume rather than the entire five-volume set if you want. That's around. We have it in the gift shop.
Right. Oh, sure. Good. And people can go online and buy it, right?
Yes, it would be available online.
Tremendous. Yeah. All right.
But also, Washington's relationship with John Marshall. Washington was a contemporary of John Marshall's father, Thomas Marshall. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a mentor relationship that Marshall has with Washington. John Marshall served with Washington in Valley Forge, at Brandywine, in crossing the Delaware, all of mm-hmm. these things that really kind of secured George Washington in the revolutionary mind. Marshall is there. Marshall is in the encampment. And there's a lot of thought that says that John Marshall's Federalist views were really solidified while he was serving under George Washington, experiencing the hardships that he faced in Valley Forge, and the lack of equipment that everybody was getting. There was the Marquis de Lafayette had paid for uniforms to be shipped from France to be shipped up to Valley Forge, but they got harangued in Yorktown. And so, you know, you can imagine the frustration that everybody is feeling, freezing up in Valley Forge, knowing that there's warm woolen uniforms waiting for them in Yorktown that aren't getting delivered because different states have different regulations and it's not working.
Well, let's pause there. Now, that's extremely important constitutionally, okay? Mm-hmm. We're operating at that point under a very loose confederation. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't even know if at that point in 1777 or 78, whether there's even been ratification. I don't think the ratification of the Articles of Confederation even occurred till 1781. Mm-hmm. So it's basically just a states doing what states want to mm-hmm. do. And so the Continental Congress would ask them to send requisitions.
Right.
And maybe they would, and maybe they wouldn't, and maybe they'd promise, and maybe they wouldn't deliver on those promises. And so Washington and his aide-de-camp Hamilton, and now John Marshall, who's also at Valley Forge, are all seeing the weakness of the Articles of Confederation, and they all become, and I don't think it's a coincidence, they all become strong central government guys. They're fighting the British, but they're admiring the British. I mean, the British got their act together. The British have all their equipment. The British have a central government and an ability to tax. And to raise taxes and to raise armies and navies, and here are these guys out there clowning around in the woods waiting for the uniforms to show up. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really a formative experience.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you you elaborated on that point so well.
Okay, we're just a mutual admiration society, aren't we?
Yeah.
All right.
I hate to do this to you, but that's our show for today. And obviously, we only got about halfway through our tour of the John Marshall House in Richmond. So we're going to have to do another episode on this, which is coming up next week. Hey, radio listeners, isn't it frustrating when you come in halfway through the show or when you have to leave before the show's over? Well, hey, just for you, we have a podcast. You can find us on iTunes or on the Montpelier website, www.montpelier.org. In the meantime, thanks to Jennifer Hurst-Wender of Preservation Virginia for taking the time to take me on this fascinating tour of the John Marshall House. Thanks also to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler, our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, our distribution engineers, Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett, the people who do our music, the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg, and of course, our Madison Minute by Jim Blaylock, who also has a historic house, but John Marshall never went there. I'm Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.